3 years next Monday since Vladimir Putin's all-out invasion of a sovereign state. And what does he get? A path to normalization with the United States and negotiations on Ukraine without the Ukrainians. Without the Europeans, either. Instead, Donald Trump sending to Saudi Arabia his Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, and anointing fellow New York real estate mogul Steve Witkoff, who on the fly has pivoted from Middle East point man. On that score, Brussels is a long way from Riyadh. Why is retired General Keith Kellogg, touted as Trump's grown-up in the room on Ukraine, meeting EU leaders instead of spearheading the bargaining? We'll ask what's at the heart of the potential bargain with Putin and gauge how far European powers got in that first emergency summit hastily convened Monday in Paris, as an encore, by the way, happening on Wednesday. It's happening in the wake of that almighty admonishing administered to allies by J.D. Vance at that weekend Munich Security Conference. How much leverage do Europe and the Ukrainians have when the main guarantor of the continent's defense seems to prefer these days talking to Moscow? Today in the France 24 debate, normalization, but is it at Ukraine's expense? With us, they're both back from the Munich Security Conference. French Socialist Center, Hélène Conway-Mouret, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Welcome back as well to journalist Janine DiGiovanni, CEO of the advocacy group The Reckoning Project, which documents human rights abuses in Ukraine. Good to see you. Anton Kozlov, director for the International Center for the Study of Eurasia. How are you?
Hi.
And from Washington, he's a former director for NATO policy at the U.S. Defense Department. Leo Michel is visiting senior fellow at the Finnish Institute of International Affairs. Good to see you again.
Hello.
More and more of you, by the way, subscribing, we thank you, to the podcast version of the France 24 debate. No one's being sidelined here. The words of U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, his message to Europe and to Ukraine. Still, we can show you the optics. Russia rewarded with a first meeting where it doesn't have to sit down as equals with its enemy on the battlefield.
And after this meeting, I can say that it's been quite a success. The conceptual approach to further steps, it was laid down by the presidents during their phone call, and we felt great attitude and willingness of our American counterparts to push this forward actively, and we're going to do the same.
He even Anton Kozlov said that he felt not just listened to but heard by Marco Rubio. By the way, in the same breath, calling on allies to rein in Ukraine, which hit a gas pipeline in the Caspian Sea near the Caspian Sea. Sergei Lavrov, is this what he dreamed of? Or
I'm pretty sure that they're very happy now that finally the Americans decided to sort of let them in, talk to them, because Russia is not in such a great shape. And this war had a very serious impact on Russian economy, on Russian society, on everything. So they want to get out, but they certainly don't want to lose face. And if Trump will let them do that, they will be extremely happy.
What's your explanation as to why this has happened so fast?
Well, because I think Trump, he said he would stop the war in 24 hours. He didn't, but I think he wants to stop the war, because the war is bad for business, and he is all about business. And also, I think he wants to get Russia in order to counter China, because they're allies now. But and also, he knows nothing about either history or diplomacy or anything else, for that matter. I think that's, you know, he's driven by his ignorance. I'm sorry to say that, but that's what it is. And that's why he precipitated to go to, out of all places, Saudi Arabia, and start talking to Lavrov and his buddies. That's my explanation.
Leo Michel, why Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think this could have something to do with the fact that this president wants to move quickly on a number of fronts. He's been doing that on the domestic scene. But he certainly wants to do that in the international. And it probably it was just what we would say a twofer. It had two benefits. One is to establish or reestablish this in the past very good relations with Saudis, to give them a prominent role, at least in hosting this meeting. And the other is it's easier to set it up in a country like Saudi Arabia and not in a country where Mr. Putin would be threatened in any way, even by overflight, by the mandate that's out for his arrest as a war criminal.
All right. It's only the beginning, says the U.S. Secretary of State. First, they want an exchange of ambassadors and restoration of full diplomatic relations between Moscow and Washington. Then negotiations on Ukraine that eventually bring in the Ukrainians and the Europeans. And finally, money-making deals, deals, deals.
Beginning to engage in identifying the extraordinary opportunities that exist should this conflict come to an acceptable end, the credible opportunities that exist to partner with the Russians geopolitically on issues of common interest and, frankly, economically on issues that hopefully will be good for the world and will also improve our relations in the long term between these two important countries.
No fewer than four times in those press remarks, Gianni Di Giovanni, Marco Rubio talked up the carrot, if you will, for the Russians, which is we could all make a lot of money.
It's crazy because at Munich, talking to the Ukrainians, and my team at the Reckoning Project are all Ukrainians, so I'm in contact with them every day, go to Ukraine a lot. Ukrainians will not stop fighting. They would rather fight until their last breath, as they put it, rather than live under Russian occupation. So, first of all, not bringing them into these talks at all, it's not just insulting, it's laughable, because they have to have some say in their own country. And second, they will not settle for it. So you can't just impose a negotiated settlement onto a people. You have to in some way have them involved. The whole rare earth, the mineral question of which, you know, we'll give you weapons, but in exchange, we want to take your minerals. People were just laughing at it. There's an event in Munich called the Ukrainian Lunch, which happens every year. And it also happens at Davos. And it was just, I mean, people could not believe that this was on the table.
And you attended this Ukrainian lunch in Encombe. Before I ask you about it, let me open the newspaper from the Daily Telegraph this Tuesday morning. It's reporting that Ukraine's presidency got, I guess what you call in Hollywood movies parlance, an offer it can't refuse. On February the 7th, protection in exchange for a $500 billion plan that includes first look in on all mineral extraction contracts and a commission on all licenses that Kyiv sells to third parties. The Telegraph calculates that if it was agreed as such, it would amount to a higher share of GDP paid out by Ukraine than reparations imposed on Germany at the Treaty of Versailles. Okay, that's an opening gambit by Donald Trump, but how do Europeans react to that?
Well, it's a new world order when everything is based on transactions and money and deals, as you said. And in fact, you know, to be in Saudi Arabia is not just symbolic. There's a $70 billion investment to be made for the 2030 plan from the prince. And I think, you know, the Americans do not have a great share of that. And maybe that was one way of kind of saying, well, we come to you rather than going to Doha or other places where negotiations are taking place today, you know, to get something in return. And I think everything now is based on deals. And if we don't get around that, I think we will not have a seat at the table until we are capable in Europe to say to Donald Trump, well, these are the investments that we're going to make, because in fact, Europe as a whole, you know, is 450 million citizens, and it's a huge financial power if the 27 work together. Well, 27 plus the UK, because we have to look at the continent, not just the Union. And we will just have to kind of get into that mode of, you know, talking, because diplomacy, and we saw it in Munich, the diplomacy we have known so far is finished with the Americans. I mean, look at the people
finished. So let me ask you about that, because were you in the room when J.D. Vance made his speech?
Yes, and I was in the room where his envoy, Mr. Kellogg, said very distinctly that the Europeans had to stop whinging and just get into actions rather than words. And in any case, they didn't have a place at the table, at the negotiation table.
They didn't have a place?
No. And then, you know, there was silence. Then a few people reacted. And I think the president of Iceland stood up and, you know, put him in place. And then he was kind of thinking that maybe he had gone a little bit too far, seeing the reaction in the room. But I think, I don't know whether it's ignorance or whether it's kind of a lack of knowledge of the European culture and our history, but even to there, in the country where there was a Nazi party that launched a Second World War on the continent, to actually, you know, say to the Germans, you have to vote for the AfD because they are the people who have, you know, the right values and will do things right for Germany. I mean, there was total shock and disarray. And the next day, there was in the German press a drawing which I found very striking. 1938, Munich, 1938, Czechoslovakia, 2025, Ukraine. That was... that speaks to us. I don't know whether it speaks to an American.
I mean, I think I was listening to it and practically in tears, because all I could think of was, this is the erosion of American democracy, the end of American exceptionalism.
And hold on a sec, because J.D. Vance, he goes and visits the Dachau concentration camp before giving that speech. Was that speech fealty, or is that what he truly believes?
I think the thing about Vance, unlike Trump, we could look at Trump as a comic character in some ways, a dangerous comic character. Vance is strategic. He's brilliant. He's a graduate of Yale Law. He has a completely different mind than Trump. What frightened
me... So this is the United States.
This is the United States. And what really scared me was the undertones of evangelical Christianity coming through it. And if you study propaganda, and we do a lot of work on Russian Kremlin propaganda at my NGO, you could hear the level of how this reaches the American population. You have to remember that Fox News right now, for some people, is their Bible. What they hear there, they understand. And how many people are in Trump's cabinet or in his inner circle who come from Fox News? So what's really frightening, and what I took away from Munich, and I was also at the Ukrainian lunch, is that the U.S. is now the largest source of geopolitical uncertainty in the world. And Trump, in 3 weeks, he has bombarded us with a velocity, not just of the executive orders, flying close to the Constitution, and just basically disrupting any kind of order. He's going to turn Gaza into Disneyland. He's going to take Ukrainian minerals. He's not letting Ukrainians at the negotiating table. It's all, I think in a sense, it's meant to shock us into a kind of submission.
Shock us into submission? Leo Michel, how do you explain what's going on where you are in Washington?
Well, a couple of things. I agree with much of the commentary that I've just heard from your European speakers. I have to say that Mr. Vance is particularly poorly suited to give lessons on democracy or on free speech to this European audience. He is, after all, I understand he's the Vice President of the United States. He's also someone who could never accept that Donald Trump was defeated in the election in 2020. He is, in fact, an election denier. Speaking about freedom of speech, this is someone who spread horrible lies about Haitian immigrants, refugees really, in Ohio, stealing and eating the pets of white Americans also in Ohio. I mean, he is not well placed.
Lou Michel, are these just down to individual characters, or is there something bigger about the United States that we should know here in Europe?
Well, I do think he represents a sector of American opinion. What I would like to bring to the discussion is there are many other Americans, including still in government, in the U.S. military, who have served, who understand how important Europe is to the United States and Canada. They are also allies and too often forgotten. Our ties are so multi-layered, so important on so many levels. And it's not just military and defense. It's on the question of intelligence, the bilateral relationships that we have. Europe is actually just so important for the United States. You haven't seen it yet, a massive outcry against the most recent statements beginning last week with Trump's description of his phone call with Mr. Putin, then the statements by the Secretary of Defense at NATO, and then the Vice President. But in part, and sadly in part, that's also because the bandwidth of the United States public right now, it's submerged by really dangerous, I think, unprecedented things that are going on domestically with regard to the actions of DOGE, the actions of the president in trying to wipe out entire agencies, fire hundreds of thousands of U.S. Civil servants, and in the most shocking and probably illegal way. So that takes away the bandwidth to focus on the types of things that your other guests and I have focused on, in my case, for my entire career, and that's the importance of the transatlantic relationship.
And so you had, Hélène Conway-Mouret, a hastily convened summit Monday night here in Paris. There's going to be a second one for countries that couldn't get to the table. They include the likes of Canada, by the way, on Wednesday. Emmanuel Macron's doing it a second time. What's your take on what happened?
Well, I think we need action, as we were invited not to keep talking, but indeed present a plan.
Do the images that we're looking at show that Europe is proactive, or that Europe should have been preparing for this before Donald Trump got elected?
Well, of course it should have been preparing, and it should have put in place what some of us are doing now, that is to actually provide the proper military equipment to Ukraine to win that war. Because we have just helped the Ukrainians, who have done wonders with old equipment or whatever they were given, to actually survive and, you know, just push the Russians out, not letting the Russians into their territory the way the invasion could have gone, you know, fully to Kiev and then the whole country will have collapsed. We didn't actually help the Ukrainians enough because we never believed that somehow they could win. So it's too little, too late. And now we have a Trump tempo, which is indeed, I do deals in 24 hours, forcing us to act, and maybe that is a good thing. And the Canadians, of course, were to be annexed, and Greenland is to be taken over. And, you know, this kind of, we're bombarded every day with announcements that are, I think, for the Trump's supporters, for those in America that do believe that they have voted for the right person who is delivering in a speedy way and they have no time to breathe, that he's doing something else, you know, every single day, even in here. I mean, we're totally saturated by what Donald Trump thinks and does and so on. So I think, you know, he's instilling this fear that maybe they need in the United States. And I have heard it in some of the American friends I spoke to, that it's a binary system. You're with him or you're against them. Absolutely. You're not, there's no neutral word.
There's no nuance.
No, it's, you know, if you're not with Trump, automatically you're out and you're against them, and therefore you will be fired. And I think all the people around him feel that if they're not 100%, well, they could be fired in the same way as the civil servants are today.
I think one of the frightening things for me also at Munich was seeing the MAGA supporters around him, because you, at one point, I mean, during the election, you thought, where are these MAGA people? They're surrounding him, but they're not, they are not representative of America.
And as he went along, and as I'm afraid to say, as Biden became weaker and weaker, and Kamala just could not step up to this position, we saw where MAGA was and how he really accessed people on the grounds of their dissatisfaction. So I think in some ways he's a master manipulator. He knew where to go. I mean, he got the Latino vote, as we know. He knew right. how to. Yeah, I mean, and what we're seeing now is just the beginning. This is just the tip of the iceberg.
And I think we need to be very, very careful as to what is happening in our next elections here in France in 2 years' time, with the role of the social media, draw the lessons of what happened in Romania, what today is
where they
happening.
The Constitutional Court canceled the
yes,
election.
But
and forced
how did a guy that was unknown 6 months prior to the election was actually chosen to go to the second round of the election, because, you know, it was the Russian propaganda that did it. So if on one side we have the Russians, because we know their interference today, and we have the Americans that for converging, maybe different kind of start, but converging interest to weaken the European Union, just to put in place the extreme right everywhere, we're all in trouble.
And you mentioned the fact that there's no room for nuance. Keith Kellogg, Donald Trump's envoy for Ukraine, who instead of being in Riyadh this Tuesday, was in Brussels. He'll be traveling on to Kyiv after Poland, where Volodymyr Zelensky intends to take him to the front. He met with the presidents of the European Council and the European Commission. Anton Kozloff, you heard Senator Conway Mouret's review of Kellogg's performance in Munich, but what do you make? Is Keith Kellogg a nuance?
Well, I think there are a bunch of this representatives. They not necessarily know exactly what their field of authority is. They know more or less, but they're not sure. And on top of that, none of them is a professional diplomat or a professional negotiator. So I think it's a bit a kind of iffy performance. It's not at all something that, you know, Trump decided that Kellogg will say one thing and then Wentz will say something else and everybody will be confused. I think it comes naturally because Trump, his style of governance is stupefaction. Everybody has to be stupefied. And he is the master of chaos. Therefore, they can say different things. Everybody will be confused. And in the meantime, he will do his thing. And I think the most important thing is that he himself is an opportunist and he's driven by resentment. But people around him, those techno advisors, you know, like Musk, but not only Musk, there is Thiel, there is Sachs, there are others, they're real fascists. And we have to be aware of that. We have to say that. They are driven by the extreme right ideology. They're against democracy. They're against elections. They just want to have their sort of dictatorship of this wealthy, brilliant people.
So these tech moguls who all work together at PayPal, they're the ones?
Yeah.
Zuckerberg. Oh, yeah.
On the U.S. side, by the way, you talk about not being professional diplomats. On the U.S. side, you have, again, this real estate mogul, Steve Witkoff. But what about on the Russian side? We saw a man who's been negotiating releases for U.S. hostages from Russia. He's also a non-diplomat. Kirill Dmitriev, the head of Russia's sovereign wealth fund, a career investment banker who in a previous life, Anton, worked in the United States. What is it with these guys from the private sector? Tell me about Kirill Dmitriev.
Well, he is not from the private sector. He is the head of the Russian investment insurance agency, I believe. Mm-hmm. And his wife is one of the close girlfriends of Putin's daughter, I think. That's what it is. And he is there because of the money deals that they can make. You know, he's not there to negotiate diplomatic issues. There's Lavrov there for that. And I think Ushakov is there as well. So I think this is something that they also want to make money. They need money. They are running out of money. Mm. So I think this is, they send the guy, he looks kind of civilized, he speaks English. He doesn't look like, you know, a Mongol invader with, you know, a knife between his teeth. So I think that's why he's there. But what I would like to also add to what we talked about before, I would like to remind you, and, you know, what de Gaulle said back in the early 60s when he decided to withdraw France from the NATO nuclear command. He said American allies are not reliable. and therefore we have to go.
1967.
1966, I think.
Mm.
But I think, anyway, Tim Snyder, who was also at Munich, said that this is the year that it's no longer about what America says, it's about what Europe does.
Mm.
And maybe this is a reckoning moment where we really, as Europeans, need to come together, give Ukraine what they need to win the war, and be more aligned. Maybe this is a wake-up call. Maybe Trump has done something in his underhanded way that
Okay, so Leo Michel, if you're a betting man, what would you wager on the ultimate fallout of, again, a first emergency summit that took place Monday here in Paris and a second one to follow on Wednesday?
Well, first of all, on the people involved there, what I've found somewhat disturbing is that I didn't see, maybe there was someone in the back, I didn't see anyone at the U.S. table that really has had, to my knowledge at least, deep negotiating experience with the Russians. I didn't see any equivalent to, for example, a Fiona Hill, who was present and has said a lot about Mr. Trump's interactions with Mr. Putin, which are not flattering for the president. But someone who has deep negotiating and understanding experience of Russian behavior. And I thought that was an omission on the side of the U.S. participants that to me it's a little bit disturbing. I come back to this notion of speed in so many areas, both domestically and now we see internationally as well. The president seems to want to move fast and strike hard. But there are so many long-term things at stake, and not only for Ukraine, but for Ukraine's neighbors, their NATO allies, and for the overall health of the transatlantic relationship and how that will either serve to strengthen or weaken U.S. deterrence of Chinese ambitions in the Indo-Pacific.
So on that score, Leo Michel, next week you have the U.K. Prime Minister traveling to Washington, and he's been trying to bridge the gap. Can Keir Starmer succeed in nuancing, as Ellen Conway Mouret would like, the views of the U.S. president?
I don't know, frankly, but I think he was being very honest when he made a comment to the effect that while the U.K. was prepared to participate in an important way in some kind of an international monitoring or peacekeeping force, really, that he would need a U.S. backstop, meaning that U.S. capabilities in intelligence, in logistics, and so forth would be necessary to support and ensure the success of such, you know, an important force that would be needed to be interposed between Ukrainian and Russian forces. And moreover, by the U.S. simply saying, as the Secretary of Defense seemed to indicate last week at NATO, at NATO headquarters, that the U.S. would not be any part of this, to me, this seems to undermine deterrence. At least if the United States were to say we're prepared to support a force, leaving, for example, the details of that participation silent for the time being, the U.S. participation brings an element of deterrence to bad actions by Russia, which without the United States there, the Europeans would be in a weaker position and perhaps invite more Russian testing, not only in Ukraine, but in other borders, for example, in the Baltic countries, border lines between NATO allies and Russia.
And in Conway Mouret, it's good to say that Europe has to step up. But a lot of the military hardware of European armies is made in the United States. What can the U.S. do if they say we're not involved anymore?
Well, that's it. Indeed, and it was reminded France made a decision a long time ago to be autonomous, and it's the only country, because the U.K. is not. The U.K. is dependent on the U.S., as unfortunately a lot of European countries have benefited from the security guarantee that Americans have given us to the point of having nuclear bombs and American planes being able to carry them based on some European territories, with the agreement, obviously, with the Europeans. So if tomorrow there's an agreement between the Russians and the Americans that maybe there's no aggression pact on the Americans towards the
Russians.
The UK
has to follow it?
What happens?
Does the UK have to follow it?
Well, they have to, and so have
so all of those. So does that leave France as the sole nuclear power that
is an outlier? Yes, and so have
that
all the countries who have F-35s that can only take off with the American agreement. So I think, you know, we have, I mean, this is really serious. We have created this dependency because we were at peace, and for years, decades, of course, successive governments have invested their money somewhere else than in defense because we had other priorities. And now we find that we don't have enough. But at the same time, when you say that, if you add all the various European armies, the financial power of each individual countries, if you make the sum of all of that, we do constitute something which is quite substantial, except that it has to come together with some kind of agreement. And of course, it's very difficult to have 20 different countries agreeing. And thus, the meetings that we have, when you see that what President Macron did was the right thing, to call the first meeting to see what is the next step, what do we do together. And it's easier to speak at 8 around the table than 27. And the next meeting will have to go broader and kind of say, well, what do we put on the table?
And it's kind of countries outside the EU, like Iceland.
Yes,
like,
and I think we need
like
to be
Norway,
very concerned
like,
when you started by saying the Russians, you know, were very happy, they were heard, and that they were making good steps forward. I mean, Lavrov is an incredibly skilled diplomat. I mean, I've seen him many times. And I think the Russians have to put to their population that when a peace treaty is signed, they have a list of all that they wanted, which some of it is already granted before the negotiation started, on the table to put to their population and see, we went to war, but we won it. And we will have all lost because they will be in a position to communicate on the fact that Russia got everything that they wanted out of that negotiation. If we're not careful.
In the medium term, who's more exposed in all this, the UK or France?
I'd say France, because I think there's probably a closer relationship to Ukraine. I mean, the UK has been isolated diplomatically and otherwise because of Brexit. I mean, let's face it, as much as they'd like to be more involved, there is that gap. But what about, just a question, NATO troops? Putin has said NATO troops or UN peacekeepers will never be deployed in Ukraine. I mean, that might be one way or one negotiating piece. But I cannot imagine, and I'd be curious to hear what you think of this, troops in Donetsk or, you know, some kind of transition after the war, what it will look like, how Ukraine is going to be rebuilt, the transitional justice, peacekeeping troops on the ground. I can't see it.
Well, that would be hard to say, but I think Donetsk is going to stay under the Russian control, most likely. So
he wants elections, right? Putin, one of the things he's asking for is elections.
He wants elections, but I think Putin, no matter what the outcome is, he will say that he won. That's no doubt about that. Even if he's going to lose Donetsk, Lugansk, and, you know, and Kursk, he will convince, you know, his political base that they won. Even though, if you look at the objectives, when they started, they wanted to take Kyiv, they wanted NATO out to their 1997 borders. I mean, they wanted a lot. They didn't get any of it so far. So, but he will say, and his, you know, Lavrov will say that they won. That is something to expect. Doesn't mean anything. I think what really is important is for Europe to get together and realize the United States is out of the picture. They have to somehow come back to in the early 20th century, in the 19th century, Europe was a formidable military power. France, Germany, England, you know, look, you know, how many wars they fought, you know, between each other.
And just on this point, there's a country we have not mentioned so far, and which is also a neighbor to all of this. Ukraine's president this Tuesday, while the talks were going on in Riyadh, he was in Ankara, first paying his respects at the mausoleum of Ataturk, the founder of modern Turkey, and then meeting Turkey's president Recep Tayyip Erdogan, his host, offering his services as mediator, saying what a great idea it was to negotiate peace, but also saying out loud what Donald Trump has trouble stating publicly.
In my meeting with Mr. Zelensky, I expressed Turkey's strong support for Ukraine's territorial integrity, sovereignty, and independence. At the same time, I emphasize that we will provide all kinds of support to conclude the negotiation process with a lasting peace.
Recognizing territorial sovereignty and integrity of Ukraine. Is Turkey scared by what's going on?
You know, in the very early days of the war, the initial, I'd say, first few weeks, delegations of Ukrainian diplomats were sent to Istanbul. So that was really the first launching pad for any kind of diplomatic negotiations. And I think Erdogan has seen himself for quite some time as wanting to be in the center of initially the Syrian war, remember, because Russia had a huge part in the war in Syria entering in 2015. So Erdogan wanted to have a big part of that. And now with Gaza as well. So, I mean, I think he's centering himself as a statesman,
but
as a grand statesman.
The Middle East is one thing. Here,
but
is he spooked by what's going on?
It is all connected. Absolutely. Well, spooked, I don't know if spooked is the word, but I think it's more opportunistic.
Anton Kozlov.
Yeah, first of all, I wanted to say, in the past couple of weeks, there was a pretty serious rift between Russia and Azerbaijan. Over the plane that was shot by the Russians over the city of Grozny. And now they've been exchanging insults. The Russians were insulting the president of Azerbaijan. The Azeris were kind of saying bad things about Russia. Azerbaijan is Turkey's closest ally. So Aliyev wouldn't do it without sort of the blessing of Erdogan. I think Erdogan is playing his game. Turkey is an old rival of Russia. They've been fighting since early 18th century. And Turkey lost a lot of territory and a lot of battles to Russia. I think now it's Erdogan's time to take revenge.
But Leo Michel, you know, we've seen over the last years nuclear power plants inaugurated, gas pipelines from Russia going through Turkey. Still, when push comes to shove, does Erdogan side with Ukraine or with Turkey? Or with Russia, excuse me.
Well, for years, he's played something of a balancing act between his relations with Russia and those with other NATO allies. There's also another NATO ally, by the way, at least one, Hungary, whose willingness to really be part of the NATO solidarity behind Ukraine has often been under question. And Slovakia seems to have made a turn, unfortunately, in that direction as well. So I wish NATO itself were more unified, but they've done a reasonably good job so far in terms of the coordination of assistance to Ukraine. There were important changes that took place. Of course, it was under the Biden administration, but important changes to strengthen NATO in terms of its operations, in terms of the authorities of SACEUR. And something to watch in the future will be how this administration, the Trump administration, deals with NATO at an organizational level when it comes to replacing some of the key American commanders there and working with NATO allies. I don't want to join the camp that says that NATO is over, that NATO has lost the transatlantic defense relationship and the broader political and economic relationship is... it's destroyed now and it will never be. But it's different. It's different now. And I am hopeful that voices that do exist within the United States will gather together and, in essence, relearn the importance that Europe has for the United States and working cooperatively together. And there's no reason why, rationally, this couldn't take place to the benefit of all.
Ed, let me bring in Conway Mouret on this. Just what was your reaction to that clip that we heard of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the Turkish president?
I think that the Turkish president is playing a very smart game there because everything is connected. Don't forget that we have North Koreans today fighting, you know, the war alongside the Russians. Who would have thought about it 2 or 3 years ago? And now we have a Turkish president who is very similar to all the other leaders, you know, having this imperialistic kind of ambition for his country. You know, Turkey at the center of the region and, you know, not wanting Saudi Arabia to be too powerful because Saudi is getting something out of, you know, the negotiations taking place on its own soil. So we have all of this is connected. It may be regional, but I think Erdogan is coming closer to the Europe when, you know, the Europeans have criticized, and only rightly so, some of the measures and things that he has done. So he's bringing himself back into the kind of European, if you like, support team. The Chinese have also indicated in a very quiet way. We haven't heard them and we haven't spoken about them, but in Munich they were extremely active. When the Americans were playing the hard power, they were playing the soft power 100%.
Wang Yi was more moderate than J.D. Vance.
Wait to see until, you know, the Americans have actually drawn out of the international institutions to see the Chinese, you know, taking the presidencies of various committees and so on. And they have offered also their help for the Europeans to come to the table, to put pressure on the Americans to do so and so on. So this is a game where every country is playing a part, placing itself for the future, and having, when we talked about this new world order, as there are no more rules. I mean, the Americans are the first ones now to kind of say we're not going to recognize, you know, the ICC or, you know, international rules or whatever. So it's going to be, you know, who is the strongest, who is going to win. So everybody's placing their playing their parts to be in one camp, and then maybe the world would be divided into three.
With a three-way split on this issue. Before we go, last week, when he first announced this phone call of Vladimir Putin, Donald Trump seemed at times to be relaying the Kremlin's line that it can't sit down with Zelensky because he's no longer president. It's because the war has postponed elections in Ukraine and his mandate has expired. Let's take a listen.
Why is freezing out President Zelensky of this process a bit? Isn't there a danger of that?
No, I don't think so, as long as he's there. But, you know, at some point you're going to have elections, too. You're going to have an election.
Anton Kasov, who's speaking to Donald Trump? Where does this talking line come from?
Very good question, because this...
Because that sounds like... Am I wrong? Is that sound
it sounds like Putin, and Putin got it all wrong. In fact, Zelensky, while there is a war in Ukraine, there shouldn't be no elections, presidential or otherwise. So he's within his constitutional rights. And to say that he is illegitimate, he's certainly more legitimate than Putin. Let's put it that way.
Leo Michel, who's speaking to Donald Trump and saying this, to getting him to say these lines?
I'm not sure anyone needs to put those lines in his ear. Donald Trump's first of two impeachments, you'll recall, was because his attempt to essentially extort from Zelensky assistance in his political effort to discredit the Bidens, that failed. So I can't imagine that Donald Trump has some personal affinity or loyalty at all to Mr. Zelensky, unfortunately for President Zelensky.
We'll have to leave it there. I want to thank you, Leo Michel, for being with us from Washington. I want to thank as well Janine DiGiovanni, Hélène Conway-Mouret, Anton Kozlov. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.